So we are ready to proceed with the third matter on our oral argument calendar today. And if council will approach and take their seat at the table. I will ask the marshal to call the case, but don't feel like you're in any hurry. Just get settled in.
Okay, thank you.
Right, and I'll just make a few additional comments while you're unpacking and getting your materials out. So there are things that you may already be aware of. So first of all, I just want to remind you that as you approach the podium, if you will identify yourself for the record and the client that you are representing today. Second, I wanted to just remind you as well that this is a podium that is adjustable. So we've got a microphone that goes up and down and around. So you put that in a position where we are going to be able to hear your remarks today and that where it, your remarks will be captured for our recording. And then and a comfortable height as well. But don't feel in any hurry. We look forward to hearing your arguments today and in having a conversation with you about the case. So counsel for appellant, again, I'm not trying to rush you, but when you are ready, if you would just go ahead and proceed with your argument. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. I don't know if it's appropriate, but there is maybe a slight preliminary matter that I think it's just a settle.
So as soon as you're ready, you go to the podium, identify yourself, and then you can certainly inquire about what I'm not sure aware of what the preliminary matter is. So you can address that at the beginning.
Good morning. My name is Ross Troyan. I'm the attorney for appellant Jenny or J.H. Hill. The preliminary matter that I wanted to quickly address was just that I believe counsel for respondent and I would both agree, and I think this is laid out in the briefs, that the district court erred in finding two particular statutory bases. So just to settle that, we're talking about those remaining three. And
be palpable unfitness, which wasn't pleaded, and the statutes that's used to terminate rights of unknown fathers.
Correct. And so with that said, especially having just watched the previous argument and this being my first time, I think I kind of want to jump right into what I think is potentially an opportunity for this court to provide guidance to all practitioners in child protection matters across the state of Minnesota, almost regardless of whether you'd find in favor of the appellant or the respondent. I think I've laid out pretty clearly in my brief what I think are the undisputed facts that would support the notion that reasonable efforts just weren't provided in this case.
What do you think was lacking in terms of reasonable efforts? What more should the county have done?
Well, I want to take some language from the question that you just posed. It's what more should the county have done? And that will get into a legal argument that I have, which is that it maybe isn't so much about what the county can do. It's about what the parent received. So what I'm sometimes hearing from the brief from respondent or even in cases that I practice throughout the state is that, well, we've done everything we can as a county. And so, but the effect of that is to then say, well, you're exonerated then, you know, the reasonable efforts, you've done reasonable efforts because you tried. But it's what the parent is entitled to. And Minnesota Statute 260.12, paragraph H, talks about what those are. And nowhere in there is it talking about, well, efforts that the county made to procure services. It's whether the services were received. And so
what additional services did your client need that might have changed the outcome here?
Well, I think the big issue in this case is timeliness of services. So therapy doesn't start until March, which is 8 months after the case has started, 2 months after permanency has been ordered. That's a big deal. A parenting capacity assessment recommends services that are not available. So, for example, parenting classes and a parenting mentor, I think those were huge. We'd look at the basis for removal in the first instance, and we're talking about of inability to feed a newborn and lack of supervision, housing, which she addressed on her own, and then mental health concerns. So two out of the remaining three issues could probably have been addressed, or at least we should have seen whether progress could have been made on supervision and feeding through those two services that were recommended for parent capacity assessment, and nothing was done.
As I read this file, it seems to me to come down to, you know, the big issue is a mental health issue.
Correct.
She's got a diagnosis of schizophrenia. She doesn't acknowledge that or accept that diagnosis, and the treating professionals across the board seem to say she must take medication in order to function properly as a parent with this diagnosis, and without the medication, it's not going to happen. Therapy alone is not going to get her where she needs to be. Parenting classes alone are not going to get her where she needs to be. Is there any evidence in the record that would support a conclusion that, you know, had she been given more time in a therapeutic relationship, perhaps she may have come to understand the nature of her diagnosis and the need for medication?
Well, the short answer to that is not really, but maybe. So there's discussion by it's Dr. Chiava, the therapist, Mr. Nance, and I'm Dr. I think Tom Peterson, all basically agreeing that number one, people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia can parent. Number two, that they would benefit from medication, but I think most importantly, that a person who has conflicting diagnosis, now keeping in mind that she had two of these that came in almost at the same time, which was 7 months, 6 months after the children were removed, conflicting diagnosis, and somebody that has schizophrenia is going to have a very difficult time accepting that. So I think, to your earlier question,
and then she's got the ammunition of, well, here's this other diagnosis, it doesn't say this.
It's a self-serving, exactly.
How much time elapsed, or how long were the children placed out of home at the time of the permanency trial?
The time of the trial was approximately, so there were multiple dates that spanned over, I think, a month. I want to say it was at about months 13 and 14.
Sure.
And what I think bothers me a little bit too is when we talk about this PCIT therapy that was the only form of visitation that could have occurred now between the oldest child, and visitation is ceased in January of 2018, and we have a trial that concludes in late September, and nothing is done. And Ms. Hill isn't even getting therapy at the time that PCIT is ceased, and the PCIT therapist testifies that, well, we need to see individual progress in Ms. Hill's own therapy before she can engage in PCIT therapy, but they never revisit that the whole time. So yeah, a lot of time had lapsed in this trial, and I think a lot that wasn't done, possibly could have been done, even from January to the end of the trial.
This is very sad, but we're still also looking at a record that says, okay, we've got an infant who's not attached to a mother, who's not, by your own admission, can't be provided appropriate care by mother at this point. You've got a 4-year-old child with PTSD, extreme behavior problems, sexualized behavior, kind of going off the rails when she sees mom, that relationship severed, she's doing very well. Does that factor into the district court's considerations here on this termination? I mean, how much time do we wait? The laws are pretty clear that the goal here is a prompt permanent placement for the kids.
Sure. So two issues on that. First is that the best interests of the children cannot trump the first level of requirements for terminating a parental rights. You cannot just say this is in the best interest of the children. And so it's sad that sometimes children will be left in limbo during these cases. And we obviously, as a team of practitioners, judges, legislator, everything is trying to address how to get permanency established in a timely fashion for children. But when something gets screwed up in a district court case to no fault of the parent, that doesn't mean that we just say, well, automatically best interest trump the parent's interest in having due process here. And moreover, we know that the children are placed now with,
relative placement.
Their relative placement.
And the relatives have allowed contact between mother and the kids intermittently.
Yeah.
Cautiously.
Perhaps. I would have my own reasons, but I would not say that those are on the record. So, but also to your question in terms of, you know, the child's behavior, PTSD, acting out during visits and so forth, I think the testimony that was brought to light during cross-examination from the social worker shows that this is normal behavior for children that go through a child protection case, and it's going to be disruptive when they have visits with a parent and then have to leave, and they're in this, and I understand that how that impacts a child, but I still don't believe that we can just say that, well, because this is in the best interest possibly of the child to reach permanency, that we can circumvent the requirements that reasonable efforts be made.
How long was mother in weekly therapy leading up to the trial? Is it like 4 months?
It would have been, I think, closer to 6 months.
Was she consistent in
yes.
the attendance every week?
Yes, Your Honor. You would see that from the testimony of Eric Nance.
Was the testimony regarding her progress in therapy in terms of coming to accept her diagnosis and the customary medication?
Sure, and there it's kind of undisputed that there was not much progress in accepting the diagnosis, but what's also undisputed is that she continually voiced her desire to providers that she does not agree with the diagnosis and would like a third opinion. And we also have testimony from Dr. Tom Peterson that said projective testing is the only way to conclusively decide that there's schizophrenia. Now, I'm willing to settle, for point of argument here today that she's diagnosed with schizophrenia, but I do think it's important to note that there are two conflicting diagnoses, and let's defer, I suppose, to the district court's credibility determinations as to those, but, it sure would have been helpful to have a third one that had that concrete projective testing, and it's something that didn't even get looked into.
Well, it would have been helpful, but from our perspective on appeal, if we credit the district court's finding, don't we just rely upon the diagnosis?
Yes, perhaps you do. And I'll even concede for purposes of argument that you do. But that doesn't change that a person who is, or let me phrase this differently, a person, as testified to by all the experts in this case, that have conflicting diagnoses like this, are not going to accept it. Now, if we don't know what would happen if there was a second concrete one, would that have been a way for Ms. Hill to say, you know what, maybe I will take some medication now?
Was there a request by Ms. Hill during the underlying proceedings for court order for the county to do this testing or to get a third opinion on the diagnosis?
I don't have any citation to the record that I could provide to say that there was. That doesn't mean that there wasn't. What I can say for sure is that the social worker, the guardian ad litem, and all the mental health professionals that she worked with knew that she wanted a third opinion. And I guess it would be my position that if a social worker is being told that this is what a client, one of their parents wants, that should be addressed by that social worker. That's their obligation towards reasonable efforts. And going back to what I think here is, again, an opportunity for this court is to consider, in the perfect, there's really a couple of services from this case that would allow the court to expound on what is reasonable efforts, but the one that I think is most clear is the issue of the psychological evaluation. So the psychological evaluation, it's really undisputed that it didn't get done in a timely fashion. It didn't get done for 6 months. It also is undisputed that there were two inconsistent diagnoses, and due to the inconsistency, that made it unrealistic for a person diagnosed with schizophrenia to engage in a services for somebody with schizophrenia. So I'm using that language, which is directly from Minnesota Statute 260.12, paragraph H, which lays out factors the court needs to determine when deciding if services were reasonable or efforts for services were reasonable. And what the respondent is arguing is, again, well, we did what we could, therefore it was reasonable. And my argument is that nowhere in that statute does it exonerate you from saying it's, you've done what you need to do, and therefore it's reasonable. And the practical effect that this could have, again, across the state, if the court would agree that we, at the end of the day, it's the parent that's entitled to these services that should be reasonable. If an agency is working with some outside provider that's dropping the ball, that doesn't mean that the parent received reasonable efforts. You cannot circumvent that requirement by engaging with providers who don't do their job. And think of a common example that you see in these types of cases, a drug use issue. A parent has an addiction to a severe chemical, let's just say methamphetamine, and that parent, it's undisputed, needs treatment. So for 12 months, she can't get a bed. And the agency is calling everywhere, but we can't get this parent into a bed. Does that mean 12 months later that we can say she received reasonable efforts? It's my position that you can't. And I don't like hearing when I come into court representing.
A case that supports that, if the parent is put on notice that this is a need that you have, you need these kinds of services or therapy, and for whatever reason, the county, say, doesn't have the resources to provide them, but this is what you need, and this is our assessment, so the burden is on the parent. Is there a case that would suggest that that approach is an improper one?
Not that I'm aware of, but I think, again, looking just at the statute, you know, available, accessible, these are the factors as to what would constitute reasonable efforts. And I think, at least in my general practice, it kind of goes without saying that it's sort of the agency's job to be a liaison for these services. So if they were to just do a blanket assessment and say, you know, here's what you need, good luck, I would think that if I was here arguing that that's what happened in this case and that she didn't successfully reunify, that people would agree that that was just not reasonable to just sort of set somebody off on the sale. So I don't have any explicit authority for that, but I think that would be somewhat of a, I guess, an absurd result under the statute to say that we can just set a parent up and let them go. So
I'm just curious, what's the language in the statute that you would say would?
So it's
that?
Minnesota statute. Well, first, I think the one that I've focused on here is Minnesota statute 260.12, and it says that. Let me just, if I can, or even just directing your attention to that, I bookmarked this page, and I'll. When determining whether reasonable efforts have been made, the court shall consider whether services to the child and family were, and there's some that maybe don't go address directly to your point, so I'll skip over those, but, you know, available and accessible and realistic under the circumstances. So if you have a parent who, you know, can't coordinate these things for their own, has obvious chemical dependency issues, how is it going to be realistic that they get these services lined up for themselves? Or how is it that they're available? If the agency can't find it, how is a parent going to find it? So that, I think, would be the strongest authority for answering that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alicia Nguyen, and I am the attorney for respondent, which is Beltrami County Health and Human Services in this matter. Today, appellant comes before you and asks you to shift the focus of this appeal in a way that pays no deference to the district court and the district court's findings. Appellant asks you to look at cherry-picked evidence from the record and find a different outcome. Looking at that analysis, in re the welfare of the child of TCM combats that analysis. In that case, the mother struggled with chemical dependency. She made significant progress towards sobriety. And in the appellate court's findings, or in the district court's findings, it noted that she did complete some tasks towards sobriety. However, she did not ultimately do what she needed to do with her case plan in order to have her children come back into her home. And The appellate court upheld that district court decision and said, ultimately, a different conclusion can be reached when there is evidence on the record, and the district court noted the progress that was made. In this case, time and time again, you'll see that appellant is doing this in its arguments. It's very similar to TCM. In the case of the case plan, for example, appellant argues that she completed tasks on her case plan, that she did what she needed to do. She attended therapy. She completed a psychological examination, for example. But appellant fails to look at the district court's findings that acknowledge that she did do some of those tasks, but the substantial progress towards her mental health was not made under these circumstances. Appellant is basically trying to take a second bite of the apple here and cherry-pick evidence for you to demonstrate that what she believes the district court should have found are correct in regarding the district, or should have found and should have not terminated her parental rights.
Counselor, are we clear that there, chemical dependency is not an issue in this case? That's the impression I have.
That is correct.
Somebody suggested dual diagnosis program, but all of her UAs are clean. There's no sign of chemical use.
That is correct. There was a history of chemical dependency, and that history was made known to the parental capacity evaluator. When that assessment was done, she did not have up-to-date information on if that was still an issue. Therefore, she said, if this is still a problem, I would recommend a dual diagnosis or a program of that nature.
The timeline, the TPR trial is at about month 13 or 14. The kids have been out of home that entire time. We don't get a psychological assessment until 6 months in because the first provider was not cooperative and then gave an assessment which the district court didn't credit and which wasn't even received at the trial.
That's correct.
So, but we get another assessment at 6 months in that says it's schizophrenia, she's going to need medication. She refuses that diagnosis and refuses medication, but then she's in individual therapy for the next 6 months leading up to trial, where she's had the opportunity to work with a professional to understand her diagnosis and treatment needs.
That's exactly
a fair assessment of where we are.
Yes, Your Honor, that is a fair assessment.
Do you recall there being any, you know, requests made of the district court for a third assessment or for this projective testing or any other services?
I believe appellant is correct in saying that there may have been those requests or
conversations
with the social worker,
but not a motion.
With the guardian ad litem. No, there was not a formal motion. In fact, in reviewing the record, and I believe the court orders were submitted as evidence at trial, there was two back-to-back hearings where the psychological examination was discussed. The first, it was received very shortly before the hearing, and counsel made note that it appeared as it was a helpful examination, but he wanted more time to review it. At the next hearing, the county requested that the recommendations in that psychological examination be adopted, and there was no objection to that. So our argument being that if this was such an issue, if this is something that appellant really was needing, if they really needed this third examination, there should have been a motion. And that's actually discussed by the Supreme Court in the Welfare of the Children of SEP. In that case, the court goes into a specific analysis of, that case is about domestic abuse and the mother.
What's the case citation?
It is 744 Northwest 2D381.
And is that the case in which the Supreme Court said, if you go along with the case plan and don't make any objections, you're going to not have a receptive audience when you come to the appellate court and complain that certain things weren't ordered?
Essentially, yes. It discusses that proper motion to be made or to bring that to the district court's attention under Minnesota Juvenile Rule of Protection Procedure 41.06 Subdivision 4B, and that was not done here. In addition to that, we would argue that she's contributing to this delay in getting services started after that second psychological was completed. One of the reasons for that being that she is not accepting her diagnosis, so when it comes to getting med management started or therapy, those are some obstacles that we have to overcome. In a review of the record, there is a meeting that has to occur between Dr. Chiava, the social worker, I think the guardian ad litem was present as well, and appellant to discuss this diagnosis, to try to go forward with this and explain what it is, explain why the recommendations are the way they are. we took additional steps to try to make sure that this was clear to her and to explain this to her, yet she still was not receptive to moving forward. And then the argument can be made that once she did move forward with the basic checkboxes of going to therapy or attending a med management appointment, she didn't actually follow through. She didn't use that therapy to accomplish the goals, as is shown in Eric Nance, the therapist's testimony. She did not make actual progress. She built a relationship, but she did not make actual progress. So any delay that may have resulted from trying to get the second psychological completed did not really impact her. And in addition, she did have that extra 7 months that she could work on going to therapy and getting this insight into her diagnosis.
When you say the mother didn't follow through, are you referring to what, the arms worker, or what are you referring to exactly?
She didn't follow through with making substantial...
She didn't go to the therapy.
Correct, okay. Correct. So she, I would say if you look at just a checklist, she checked the box that says attend therapy. But did she actually use therapy to make a meaningful change in her mental health? We would argue she didn't. She didn't accomplish...
I want you to be a little more specific.
Sure.
So because she didn't do what?
She gained
no... She didn't accept her diagnosis and she didn't take medication?
She did not gain any insight into her mental illness. She refused to accept her diagnosis. She refused to accept how it was a danger to her children or things that she's done in the past that were a danger to her children. She refused to make actual change that would have allowed for those children to return to her home.
And when you say she didn't make the changes necessary for the children to return to her home, she did move out of the fish house, right?
She did.
Okay.
Yes. She does retain the fish house, however.
And she maintained employment. So what didn't she do?
So the things that she didn't do, and maybe I'm not being entirely clear, appellant's mental health is the significant issue that is making this difficult for us to move forward. She needs to take steps. One of them is medication, and that is a significant one. That is one that is agreed upon by all of the experts that could potentially, could. We don't know for sure because she hasn't tried them, but it could potentially lead to a safer environment. I noted from appellant's arguments that when he was discussing Dr. Peterson, he was the medical management professional specifically, his statement was that, yes, you can have parents that function properly. He did provide additional analysis about appellant and saying that, you know, if she were to take medication and if she had a strong family support, then perhaps she'd be able to parent her children. So we recognize that there is a spectrum with mental illness and with schizophrenia specifically. Appellant is just falling on the side of that mental illness where she's not doing everything that she can so that we can properly assess if she would be able to have those children back, if she would be capable of not being a danger to her children.
What examples does the record provide of instances in which she was a danger to her children as a result of her untreated schizophrenia?
So in the very beginning of the case, there were examples of her not providing supervision to the 4-year-old child. We, at that time, didn't know that mental illness was the contributing factor to that, but when you look at the therapist's testimony regarding her disorganized thoughts, regarding her lack of insight, regarding her disconnect between understanding dangers for her children, you can look back at those circumstances and see the danger that the mental illness contributed. In addition, throughout our case, we did have a couple of examples where she would do things that exhibited her paranoia. I believe one example was during the parental capacity evaluation, she was handed a bottle and she thought that that bottle was poisonous. She would not feed it to the baby. So that's an example of how her mental illness is playing into a paranoia that if I provide this to my child, it will be harmful, when in actuality, it's a bottle. It's feeding your child. It's something that your child needs. She's not able to understand and recognize her children's needs because that mental illness is holding her back. There were a couple of other examples throughout our trial. Another was a example where she called the foster parent in the circumstance and stated that she could hear the children screaming and she thought that her oldest child was drowning in a pool. That was not the case. She was not present. She wasn't anywhere near the child. So this extreme paranoia has already demonstrated that there's an impact on the children, and there would be the concern that if those children were returned to her, that paranoia would take over and there would be additional harm that we wouldn't be able to assist with or prevent. I think another issue that is discussed regarding reasonable efforts and something that appellant draws in the brief that was submitted is visitation and questions regarding visitation. Was visitation reasonable? Were the changes that were made to visitation reasonable? We would argue that they absolutely were. When you look at those reasonableness factors that counsel was discussing under 260.012H, those factors are playing a role in every decision that's made with regards to visitation in this case, and that's apparent. When we first start with visitation, yes, we have supervised visitation to understand the family's needs, to see where we go from there. And eventually, there was a change to that visitation. Visitation was adjusted due to concerns noted by professionals regarding the oldest child's behaviors, the relationship being damaging to the oldest child, and further, the psychological evaluation and the understanding of the mental health component. So when you're looking at visitation and you're considering the safety and protection of the children, when you're considering was it reasonable to continue visitation for that oldest child, given all of the circumstances and with an understanding that this relationship or any continued visitation when appellant is not addressing her mental health could be damaging, yes, it was. It was realistic, and it was adjusted based on the circumstances of the family. So that would be an issue that we would argue was reasonable under the circumstances. Another issue that appellant raised was regarding the parenting skills that were offered. Those parenting skills were initially recommended through a parental capacity evaluation. That was an additional service regarding the parenting skills that the county offered. And the initial report came back with a parenting mentor, a couple of other things that, as appellant has noted, are limited in our community. What we did in those circumstances is we tried to find comparable services that would also offer support for appellant. We offered parent-child interaction therapy, which is PCIT. We made sure that the visitation was supervised and there was intervention or feedback provided following it. And we also gave coaching by case managers. And it's also important to note that once that psychological came in and the parental capacity evaluator received that psychological evaluation, those recommendations from her changed. They changed to state that, you know, she may have the cognitive ability to watch someone and understand that this is how you insert a bottle in a child's mouth or do something of that nature. But to actually make changes to her parenting with this significant mental illness hindering her, that's going to be something that she's not able to do, and the children would be in danger in her care. So noting that, this case evolved over time, and things became known throughout the entire case, and we had to adjust to those circumstances. Those parenting skills for this mother were no longer appropriate because they weren't able to sink in. The mental illness was what we had to treat first. Once we were able to do that, then we would be able to, hopefully, if she was able to make progress, make those changes in the parenting skills. But even at the time of that updated report, the evaluator no longer had those recommendations for parenting skills. And I see that I am coming up on my time. If there are no other questions...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. I just have jotted down some notes on things that were discussed that I think are important to address. So I'll just start from the top of my page here. The question was asked, what type of examples do we have of when the parents apparent mental illness was impacting her ability to supervise or parent the children. And respondent gave the examples of not supervising and then exercising what I have characterized as hypervigilance, such as making sure a bottle doesn't have poison. Maybe it was delusional to think it had poison in there. But does that make the child unsafe to say, I'm going to take this bottle and give you one that I don't think has poison in it? Same would be true with calling the foster parent and asking, is my child safe? Maybe there wasn't a good reason to believe that the child was safe, was unsafe, but it didn't put the child in any kind of harm. She was exercising, perhaps delusional, but hypervigilant behavior on those. The examples of not supervising predate the case, for one. For two, there's two instances. One is where they're at a public park and the mom's in the bathroom. The other is when mom is performing at a public concert for the Bemidji band, sitting, you know, up in the front row with her child there, and she runs off during the last song or two. So that's it. That's what the record shows. with regard to visitation, the word adjusted was used. No, visitation with the oldest child was ceased entirely in January of 2018. And that issue was never revisited by the social worker. The testimony is clear on that, despite the fact that the mom had started engaging in therapy and despite the fact that it was the PCIT's therapist's opinion that she needed to work on her therapy. So that could and should have been revisited. With regard to whether it was mom's or appellant's job to ask for a third opinion, number one, I think it's significant that she was asking social worker providers, so on and so forth. But number two, let's not forget the fact that the case plan was never updated. All these things that are talked about, arms worker, the first time that got talked about was at trial. That's not in a court order from that, prior to that, anything. So, you know, the social worker could have updated the case plan as well in talking about these things. And moreover, I hope you can understand how a case progresses here. We're in January when these psychological evaluations come out, and it's not more than about a little less than a month that the permanency is ordered. That's the trajectory at that point. Visits are ceased, we're looking at trial dates, and that's it. And that's what the social workers or social services, that's essentially what's going on in this case at that point. So for mom to try to think that she's going to be getting a psychological evaluation that's somehow going to save the day for her, I think is a little unreasonable to expect. You know, trial dates are getting set and then all of a sudden canceled because the doctor's not available and then moved out. So that's the trajectory at this point. So if it was early on and mom didn't agree with the case plan that had been filed with the court at the outset, fine, maybe she needs to file a motion to ask for something different. But when it's 6 months later and the county is supposed to be updating the case plan and nothing's getting done on that and we're talking about permanency, it's a different situation. To answer your question, I think there was Justice Bradfield, there was a question on what didn't mother do. And I think everybody can see the elephant in the room. Mom didn't take medications. That's it. And so what does that mean in this case? Was she entitled to more timely services in that, more consistent services before we decided that ultimately we would just move to permanency and cease visitation? I think it's important that there is not much service offered in lieu of the parenting classes or mentor. They talk about a coaching from a case manager. This is the same case manager that suggested that the foster parent just feed the child prior to visits when we knew feeding was an issue. So I see that I'm out of time, so thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. This matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So with that, we have completed the matters on our oral calendar today. We will now recess to do our non-oral calendar.
All rise. Ms. Wynn's been here quite a few times, but you say this is your first time?
First time.
Yeah, thank you.
It felt good.
You wouldn't know it was your first time.
Looking forward to it.